Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and myself, Tris Dixon. This week, we are going to talk about co-commentators and co-commentating. Gents, I mean, I'm going to ask you, John, I'll go to you first. Have you actually shared a co-commentator with Ian before? Is there someone that springs to mind that you've both worked with?
Oh, many of them, yeah. I mean, we both started in the radio days. Not so much we've not so much shared commentators in our television time, but in our radio career, I mean, we both started working alongside Henry Cooper, Colin Hart, Ian going a little bit further back, Alan Minter, you know, who I obviously knew. And we do share common ground in that one, though not so much, I don't think, in television.
Ian, of those names that John just mentioned there, I mean, have you ever exchanged notes with John ahead of time saying what's so-and-so like?
Well, I think when John took over from me, yeah, I think he might have gently asked me about what it was like working, particularly with Henry Cooper. And I started working with Henry. Henry had worked with the great Desmond Lynham before me, so he had a bit of experience, and he loved Sports Report. He used to say every time he was on Sports Report, he'd win his fights the following Wednesday, because they used to be on Wednesday most of them in those days. So he was in love with the programme. And Harry was great, really, because the job, and it was radio, of course, for us then, BBC Radio, John and I both worked there and started there as boxing commentators. The job, really, of the co-commentator was to fill the minute between the rounds. You did a blow-by-blow account as best you could of what was going on in the 3 minutes, and Henry would come in, and he would always, by that stage, he was very good at it, he would fill the minute. Just talk for the minute, and out he'd come just before the start of the next round. And it worked like clockwork. And, of course, he was so loved by everybody that, you know, our Ennery and all that. So just trying to walk across a room with him on your way to ringside, that'd take about 10 minutes because everybody'd want his autograph.
You're more like,
I mean, he was great to work with. Sorry?
You're more like his minder.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, nobody asked us. You know, we were just these radio hacks who did the blow-by-blow. He was the star.
Yeah, he's a lovely fella as well, Tris. I mean, I did my last one with Henry when he commentated on Bruno against McCall. He decided that was it after that. But he'd been doing it for many, many years before then. And, you know, I remember going to see Bruno fight Tyson the first time in Vegas, and all of us were absolutely shot to pieces with jet lag as ever. I mean, I suffer appallingly with jet lag, as most people do, but Henry just didn't seem to suffer from it one little bit. So I said to him, Henry, what's the trick? And he said, brown paper boy. He said he did cut out pieces of brown paper in the shape of his feet and puts it inside his socks. And he reckoned that that was what stopped him getting jet lag. Yeah. I mean, I think it might have been something to do with the fact that as soon as he sat down in a seat on a plane, he was instantly asleep. He was one of those lucky souls. While we're reading the paper and looking at films and generally, you know, messing about, he was absolutely out for the count.
It was absolutely lovely. I remember him quelling a riot single-handed at that Tony Simpson Frank Tate fight in Stafford. I mean, the place was about to take off. I mean, already there were like CS gas canisters flying around. Henry grabbed hold of the microphone alongside me, that the ring microphone, the MC gave it to him, and said, "Come on, everybody. Please behave yourself. Get back to your seats. Behave yourself. This is a boxing night. Come on." And like little lambs, all these hooligans just wandered back to their seats. And, you know, Henry had done it single-handedly. It was almost like a biblical thing. It was on the front page of the Times the next day. How Henry had just made peace break out at the, amid this riot. The other great Henry story I've got is later on, when I was presenting Sports Report, I was lucky enough to present that great, fantastic show. And it was an April Fool we decided to do. And I said to Henry, George Foreman had just was making his big comeback at the time, you know, in his 40s and all that. And I said, why don't you just pretend you're doing making a comeback, Henry? Well, he had a great sense of humor. So he loved this idea and did this great interview with me saying that he'd been to America secretly to train. He'd even done some work with Foreman. He still felt as fit as ever. He was going to be back in the ring, and he was going to shock everybody. He was looking for big fights and he was hunting again. And he carried it off so well that we got a phone call when the program went off air from the Sunday Mirror saying, this is our back page lead tomorrow. Can you let us have the tape again so we can get all the quotes down? And we had to explain to them this was an April Fool.
That's great.
He was lovely company on the golf course. I mean, it won't surprise you to know that his swing was not a great thing of beauty. He was a left-hander, but I tell you what, when he hit a ball, it stayed hit. It was all left hand, smashed it, and it wasn't pretty, but he got it round there. But he was just charming company. I remember once going down to his house. It was after he'd left Hampstead. He was living, not Hampstead, just North London there where he lived. He'd moved down into Kent. And he said, I went down there to do an interview with him. I'd driven halfway across the country. And he said, don't suppose you've got the clubs in the back of the car, have you, boy? And I said, I have actually, Henry. Yeah, he said, do you want a game? So we went off and played around the London Links course, just me and Henry. Then into the clubhouse afterwards, where he bought a great big plate of sandwiches, looked after me. We went back home. His delightful wife cooked us tea when we got in, made us dinner, you know, and I'm just about to go thinking, wow, what a day this has been. And I'm just getting into the car and Albina runs out with a bottle of vintage wine and passes it on to me and says, thank you so much for coming down today. Henry's had such a good time. I thought, goodness me, I'm being thanked by somebody who's provided me with one of the best days of my life. But that was Henry. He was so kind. He was very genuine. And, you know, if you got him as a booking for a little, you know, a kids club or something, if he'd agreed to come along, somebody would come along and offer him a corporate do and say, look, there's 10,000 quid in this, Henry. And he'd say, no, I'm already booked. He was a man of his word and he'd stay with the boys club. And that was one of the reasons, I think, Ian, wasn't it, that the public just loved him so much. He was one of them. He was so down to earth, such a genuinely very nice man.
Yeah, lovely. I mean, he'd be right up there, wouldn't he, in the popularity stakes of all-time British boxing. I mean, that golf shot you mentioned, John, his great drive, didn't he have a hook? Must have had a left hook, mustn't he, Henry?
Left hook in the trees.
I never played golf with him. You're one up on me there, John. I never played golf with him, though. He did say to me one day, you know, he said, my leg's been aching last couple of weeks. I went to see the doctor. He said, I'd been bitten by an adder. I said, what? You've been by a snake and didn't know it. He goes, yeah, it must have been. And I didn't feel a thing. He said, it's hurting now a bit.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Hey, John, obviously Ian kicked off there talking about the role of the COCOMs and really sort of to dominate the minute in between rounds with expert analysis as to what's going on inside the ropes. Is that the way that you see it? Is that like a broadly held thing from producers, like, you're doing the play-by-play and then you're bringing in these guys to summarize the action and say what might come in the next round? Is that how you see it? And is that what you've been taught?
I think, well, nobody actually teaches you these things. You sort of pick it up as you go along. And as Ian said, I'd have spoken to him and I guess he'd have spoken to Desmond Lynham or whoever to get advice prior to that. But you sort of learn as you go along. Radio is very different to television. I think radio commentary nowadays, I know talk sports have started to do it more like television commentary. So you've got two or three voices chiming in and you don't have the one descriptive voice during the round, which personally I like. followed by the minutes expert analysis between rounds. I think that's the better way to do it. But that's, it's not so important to have the rapport, I don't think, on radio, but on television, it's absolutely vital. You've got to get on with the bloke next to you. You've got to make each other laugh. You've got to be on the same wavelength. And you kind of know almost by instinct when to speak and when not to speak. And when you have a really good commentator, co-commentator relationship, that's the way it is. You know, Steve, Ian had Glenn McCrory. I've had people like Duke McKenzie, Barry Jones, Richie Woodall, you know, and it helps very, very much if you get on with these fellas socially, as we all did.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, I mean, you're talking about the technicalities of the job. Yes, of course, it's much different on radio because people can't see it. So they're much more reliant on you. Say, if you're watching a fight on TV, you can have your own ideas about who's winning it. You might not agree with the commentators. On radio, you are the eyes and ears. And it's more or less like, unlike any other sport, isn't it? Boxing. You don't actually know who's winning. It's being scored secretly somewhere on somebody's notepad, either the referee himself or the judges. So you want the co-commentator, in my case, Henry, when I started on the radio, to be giving you a good idea about who he thinks is winning the fight. Now, if Henry had one weakness, and he didn't have many, he'd often sum up the round something like this. He'd say, well, as you said, Ian, that was a good start to the round. He threw a few couple of good left hooks there, and he landed with those. He hurt him with that body punch, but then the other geezer's come back, and he's got him with that left jab. You know, a couple of times he's got his jab going, and, you know, I've scored it an even round. And he often used to say, I've scored it an even round. And in one of the fights, I had to say to him, Henry, we've got 8 even rounds so far. I said, I think the judges are having to find a winner of some of these rounds. Which way do you think it might be leading?
That's great. And then, so Ian, I'll stay with you on this. So obviously we talked about one British heavyweight icon there with Henry. I know you've done work with Frank Bruno. Sometimes these guys are brought in because of name value and name power rather than they're following the sport particularly closely. What was it like working with Big Frank?
Well, it only lasted 1 or 2 nights. So we had Frank working. I mean, he's lovely. Of course he is. He's, you know, Mr. Popularity as well. And it's a great name to have alongside you, and people are hanging on his views of the fights. But I mean, Frank's problem was he had a little bit of problems with the names of the fighters. So we're doing a bout in America. Frank was out there. So we brought Frank in. It was an undercard fight involving a promising young fighter at the time called Chad Broussard. You probably know him, Tris. Yeah, he was quite decent. So, but for some reason, Frank couldn't get that name in his head. So at the end of the first round, after I finished the contest, he goes, "Yeah, he looks like a bit of a mean machine, this Glad Jacobs." And I'm going, me and Bob Mee sitting alongside me, looking at each other. Who's he talking about here? I said, you mean Broussard, don't you, Frank? He goes, yeah, it looks all right. so it went on a bit like that. So, it wasn't his forte, Frank. I think, you know, if you wanted to use Frank, it was best to use him in the studio where everybody could see him and he could, you know, display the full range of his personality.
It's a very different skill, that, isn't it? Actually being a panelist to being a commentator. You know, people, I think everybody who has done both would say that from a broadcasting point of view, it's very much more difficult to be a commentator and be alongside the likes of Ian and myself. It's more difficult than just to sort of fill in a bit of time before fights and after fights and look pretty on the television. You know, I think the commentary's a definite art, which some people get and others don't.
Yeah, and you've got to read the fight, haven't you? That's the main thing, I think, when you're the co-commentator. You've got to be giving insights. And I always used to say to co-commentators, not only in boxing, but football as well, which I cover, and I'd say, look, tell me things I can't see for myself. I can watch 1,000 fights, but I'll never know all the intricacies and the little things that you'll pick up on because you did it at the top level yourself. I never got in a ring and fought with guys like this. So that's what you want a color commentator to do, to bring you those graphic insights, just little things. And when I worked with Jim Watt, he was especially good at that. I think he could see when a fighter was hurt or when he was fading in a fight, and just had that empathy and almost could see inside the mind of the two fighters in there and brought that to you as well. And often he was almost ahead of the game before anybody else had really picked up the fight was changing. And you need, I think, your co-commentator to be able to do that. And another point is, I think, I always used to say to the guys working with me, look, don't be frightened to disagree with me, because we could lead each other up the garden path here, and the viewers as well. If I'm just thinking I've got to agree with how you saw the fight, it's good to have a second opinion on it, because you can be seeing it wrong. It's why I always admired Harry Carpenter. He had to do it nearly all on his own on the TV. He never had co-commentators. It just wasn't the thing in those days. And, you know, Harry got most of it right along the way, you know, as much as you could hope to get right, did it brilliantly all those years.
Yeah, well, I was recently watching a fight that Howard Cosell was commentating on. I kept waiting for the co-commentator to intervene, and there was none. Cosell was doing a lot on his own back in the day.
Remember,
Harry was journalistically trained, wasn't he? He was a Fleet Street Fleet Street writer, so he kind of had the ability to know the story. And I think when Ian and I have both worked with Colin Hart, for instance, who was very much the pack leader of the red top journalists back in the day, as the number one boxing writer for The Sun for goodness knows how many years, and Harry Mullen as well, who is the editor of Boxing News and much respected. They'd be covering fights and kind of know instinctively as it goes along what's likely to be the headline story coming out of that fight, and they were very strong from that point of view. They might not have had the technical insight that you'd have got from working with a former fighter, but my goodness, they knew the stories and they would really deliver in that manner.
There's no right or wrong way to do it either. It's like commentary generally, it's all pretty subjective. What you think of the guys doing it. You know, some people love one guy, but to another person, he's a pain in the backside. We see that all the time, and you're getting a good insight onto it on Twitter as well. But you mentioned Colin Hart there, John. Brings to mind, I mean, I did Marvin Hagler against Tommy Hearns within, you know, that great, wonderful fight in 1985. I did that for the radio, all three rounds, all 8 minutes of it. And for the only time ever in his life, and the only time I've ever known him, at the end of the first round, it was so breathtaking, so furious, so spellbinding, that for about 5 seconds, Colin couldn't talk. He was like choked up, and he it was great broadcasting, because when he did come in, you could hear it in his voice. And he loved the sport, he loved boxing, and he knew what he'd just seen. And he said, "That was the greatest round of boxing I will ever see in my life," and or words to that effect. And I thought, you've hit it there. Okay, there was that delay, but the delay was great, really, because it had been that incredible. And Colin came in. I mean, he just happened to be beside me a couple of big ones like that. And he much later on, Mike Tyson, Buster Douglas. I did that with Colin as well. So, you know, he did another great job there.
So one thing that you touched upon at the start, Ian, was about your rapport with a co-commentator. So, John, I'll go to you first with this. This rapport, by the way, I'm guessing, through everything that you do, and we have spoken about this in terms of living the fight and going away to big, big fights, and you must build this rapport away from the ring. So, John, particularly you back in the day with Richie Woodall, Barry and Duke, who I think, you know, are the three that I probably most associate you with. You must have so many travel stories of sat at restaurants with them, last orders at the bar in the hotel afterwards. And this is where I guess your relationship is formed and forged, where you're talking about, where you're not necessarily just talking shop all the time and you're becoming close, right?
You're becoming friends, aren't you? I mean, I count those three very much as friends. who I've known for many, many years. And they're very different people. You talk about sitting at bars. You didn't sit at the bars with any of them very much, because Barry doesn't drink. Duke barely drinks. And if he does have one, it goes straight to his head. So it's not a very good idea. And Richie might have a couple of pints of Guinness and that's it, you know. So it's not sort of late night carousing with loads of alcohol around, but it's just getting on with people and finding out what makes them tick. And if you like somebody and you find them interesting and you find them amusing, that comes across in the commentary. And if people can laugh together, you're not always criticizing, you're not always being coldly analytical. Sometimes there are funny moments in fights and funny moments in broadcasting. And I think the ability to laugh is so important, because it makes people listening feel as though they're joining in something which is special between two people.
Ian, late night carousing and having a few drinks. You worked with Glenn McCrory for a while.
I can't think what you mean. Tris. I mean, there was no such thing as a quiet night in, really, with Glenn. I mean, we used to make big jokes of it, and John was around with us in Vegas a lot of times, you know, and Glenn would say halfway through the day, and we used to take the mickey out of him, you know, it was a bit like the vultures, you know, on those wires in the Jungle Book. So he'd go, what are we going to do then? What are we going to do tonight? In that Geordie accent of his. And we'd all have a laugh. And say, well, I don't know, you know, we'll just go for a drink somewhere and, you know, grab a bite to eat. And of course, you know, you mentioned last orders. There were no such thing as last orders, really, with Glenn. I mean, I used to joke to him, because we'd be on the plane going over to Vegas to cover the fight. And the flight attendant would say, would you like a red wine, Mr. McCrory? Because they had your names, because we were lucky enough to travel business class. We were kind of privileged like that. And I'd interrupt and say, don't bother about keep asking him about a glass. I said, just fit an intravenous drip. He'll be fine. we're painting a bad picture of Glenn there, making it sound like he was some kind of drunkard on these trips. I mean, Glenn liked a good night out, but he could do all that and still turn up and do a great professional job for you the next day. I mean, I mentioned the warmth. Glenn had that, I think, you know, in bucket loads. He just had that. I remember, you know, from the very first time I went up to do a radio interview with him, he was a natural. You could tell. I thought, this guy's going to end up doing some broadcasting. And very quickly after that, while he was still fighting, I think we had, you know, Henry couldn't do it 1 week. And so Glenn McCrory was put in. We hired him. So it all started from there, really. And, you know, he just had a great way of, I think he had that empathy with the fighters. And I mentioned that vital quality. He could read a fight.
And he was great fun. He was great fun, wasn't he? I mean, he was the best man. He was the best man at my wedding when I got married in whatever year it was, 1999 or something. Mm-hmm. And he said afterwards, he said, standing up and talking in front of that group of people, because there were one or two quite well known people in there, mm-hmm. including Ian. He said, that was one of the most nerve-wracking things I've ever done. He said he was actually physically sick in the toilet before he went and made the speech. You know, he was so keyed up about it. His first, his opening line, I'll always remember, he said something like, it's really nice to be here speaking to you today with John and Becky getting married. He said, unfortunately, I lost my wife last week. Hell of a game of cards that was.
That was a great line. Yeah, I've used that myself actually since then. Actually, you talk about best man. I was best man at one of Glenn's weddings as well.
one of several.
Jeez, this is great stuff. Hey, John. By the way, okay. So if you didn't have the late night carousing with Glenn and the gang, tell me you. One of the other things that you endure with these guys is the travel, right? I mean, sometimes it is business class, or dare I say first class for you very experienced guys. But, you know, there's a certain closeness that comes when you travel with someone around the world, isn't there?
Yeah, you get to, you understand people's, it's not all lasses and big night out. If somebody's coming with problems one way or another, then you share in that and you talk through things and you're stronger as a team. That's all part of the friendship building process. And when you're out on the road and you've got these long journeys, sometimes, you know, if you're flying to Los Angeles or something, you're 10 hours on a flight. Mm. There's a lot of time to fill there. So you can get to know people pretty well. And it's not all tales of derring do and, you know, and seeing the bottom of a glass and a well-turned table leg. You know, there's more to it than that. And it's actually just getting to know people and knowing what makes them tick.
Mm. Jim Watt used to be, I mean, you probably never got that much of a sense of it on the air. I mean, Jim was a consummate pro. He looked great on camera. He was sharp with all his observations, all that kind of thing. But he was a very funny guy, was Jim. I mean, and also he used to do magic tricks. We were in a Vegas bar once, and he said he got out this sort of this little box of stuff, and he said let's play a trick here. There was only us two in the bar and the waitress, and he's put this little pink thing on your finger and another one on your thumb, so if you touch the finger and the thumb it illuminated, and he had another one on. So I go to the bar and order some drinks, and Jim lights up his own finger and thumb and says, Ian, catch this, and throws it. I put my finger and thumb together at the bar, and the light looked like it had traveled right across the room. And the waitress looked at us and goes, are you guys from Mars? So Jim was always coming up with little things like that. I mean, the other thing with Jim, he was a great golfer.
Very good
so
golfer.
Much so that, you know, during the summer, when if it was a slow period with the fights, he would go out and play on his own at Glen Eagles or somewhere like that, or somewhere more local to his house. Terrific at golf. And of course, you know, he had the great partnership before he ever worked with us, working with Reg Guthridge, you know, famous ITV pair all those years. I was a bit nervous, really, to be honest, to be working with Jim after that, because I was thinking, well, you know, he had all that chemistry with Jim. Is he going to like working with me?
Well, you were the voice of Sky Sports with Jim for a long period of time, and you covered some huge fights. And I guess that you and Jim became firm friends. I think he went through a lot personally during his time at Sky with stuff away from the ring. I'm guessing he used you as a shoulder often, Ian, right?
Well, both John and I went to, I mean, it is terrible what's happened, really, to Jim and Mags. You know, they've lost two of their children. And I can remember, you know, going up to the one of the funerals and standing there. And I remember Jim, I don't know how he was doing it. I don't know how he got through the day. And we just sort of put an arm around his shoulder, and he just said to us, I've had to just put my fight face on here today. It's the only way I could do this. So, I mean, you do feel for the family. There was that awful feeling of tragedy around his family. But occasionally I still give Jim a call and you know, see how things are going. It's a pity we live a long way apart, because I'd like to have a few games of golf with him too.
Well, let's get him on the podcast in the near future, and you guys can go down memory lane.
Yeah, why not?
They're special people, aren't they, fighters, and particularly those who want to continue in it afterwards. They're often very kind, very giving people who are strong and offer a lot to society in different ways. I remember back in, I think it was about 2005 or thereabouts, my mum passed away, and I'm going to go to the crematorium, where actually I was giving an address. So I was turning up early so that I'd be in control of my emotions. And I walk to the end, towards the entrance of where the service is going to be held. And there's a figure in a dark coat standing there. And I sort of looked twice. I thought, goodness me, who's this? And I looked again, and there it was. It was Duke McKenzie. And he said to me, I said to him, Duke, what are you doing here? I said, you've come all the way from South London, from Croydon, all the way up to Derby. I said, you never met my mother. And he said, no, John, he said, that's not the point. He said, I'm here for you. And I thought, what a lovely thing to do. What a lovely thing to do.
Yeah, great bloke, Duke, isn't he?
Highly unsurprising with Duke. Duke, by the way, I'm sure if we were doing this with Duke, he would be able to tell us about his co-commentary with Nassim Hamed, where Naz has gone rogue a few times of late on, what was it, on ITV4, I think, when he was putting the boot into Eubank Jr., which either of you ever commentate with Naz, by the way?
Mercifully, no.
No. I never saw him as a future co-commentator, if we're honest.
Well, hey, this is where we're coming.
I commentated with Lennox Lewis once. He wasn't cut out for it at all. It was on that Tyson Ruddock bill at the Mirage in Las Vegas. And, of course, we don't only have to commentate on the big fight. We were commentating on the undercard as well. And it was a terrific welterweight title fight going on. I think it was Maurice Blocker and Simon Brown going on. Terrific fight. And after about seven rounds of it, Lennox just said, we went to an advert break. And Lennox just put the mic down and said, he goes, I can't really get into anything that's not heavyweights. And so I had to do the last five rounds on my own. he just disappeared from the commentary.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I commentated with Tyson Fury once. I was over in Canada when Billy Joe Saunders fought over there in Montreal against Lemieux. And the main commentator there alongside me was Barry Jones. But Tyson was there, of course, because he was a mate of Billy Joe's. And they put him in the box. And he was so good. He was, you know, he's a very articulate man anyway. And he just reads the game and reads fights extremely well. I strongly suspect that in years to come, I don't think we're going to be kissing goodbye to Tyson Fury when he finishes as a fighter. I'm fairly sure that he'll be continuing in one way or another, probably as a broadcaster.
Yeah, I think that's a good bet, John. I mean, we both work with Richie Woodall, haven't we? You know, and Richie's still going strong. He's always there. I mean, one of my favorite people in boxing, Richie. And I think he's a terrific, very professional co-com, isn't he? Down to earth. And I think he sees all the nuances going on in the ring.
He's meticulous in his preparation, isn't he? He doesn't come along and just try and wing it. You know, he's very, very professional in the way he prepares for fights. He knows everything about the guys involved and brings that across.
Well, I mean, if it's modern day, he's generally had them on the pads or had them in the performance center in Sheffield, isn't it? But before that, he'd either fought them or trained alongside them or been in the same stable or the same camp. He's done it all, hasn't he, Richie? But like you said, extremely professional and one of my favorite guys in British boxing. He's right up there, very, very consistent in terms of what you see is what you'll get from Richie. A nice, straight, honest guy, isn't he? I mean, I don't know if I'm probably not doing him justice there.
He's the only guy, Tris, that I know who used to train to George Formby records going on in the gym. I mean, it was fantastic. You know, he'd be there on the pads and you'd hear George Formby in the background, you know, when I'm cleaning windows.
They're not always quite as professional as Richie, you know. I was talking to Ian when we were talking about possibly doing this one about commentators. There was a woman who worked for BBC Radio many years ago, who was she had some, I think it's fair to say, some fairly unusual ideas, and she had the idea of using Mickey Duff as a co-commentator on a fight which he was vaguely involved in. I mean, I was presenting it, Ian was commentating, so Ian finishes the round and hands across to Mickey Duff, whereupon Mickey, instead of doing his little 60-second summary of what he's just seen, he actually puts the microphone phone down, stands up and starts bellowing at one of the fighters in the corner, who presumably is something to do with his promotion, and he starts bellowing instructions instead of talking down the radio. That was an interesting one, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I'd forgotten that until you said. Needless to say, Mickey wasn't hired again that soon to do any more. But you can't have the promoter, can you, being the co-commentator for obvious reasons. It's not going to be too neutral an opinion.
And I once commentated with Kevin Kelly on a big fight at Madison Square Garden, bearing in mind he was from Flushing in New York, so very, very popular man over there. We're sitting in the commentary position at ringside, and he says, I've had a swig of water, and he said to me, just whispered to me while I was commentating, can I borrow your water bottle? Can I have your water bottle? And I said, yeah, no problem, and passed it along. Whereupon, pulls Dante out to the floor, flops out his manhood, and fills the bottle. So I'm commentating while Kevin Kelly's having a wee alongside me in the commentary position.
Oh my God.
He said afterwards, I couldn't go to the toilet because I said I'd never get back. Everybody would have been asking for autographs. I'd never have got myself back. So I was actually having to commentate with the former world featherweight champion urinating in his water bottle by my side.
No, more to the point, John, you saw the flashing flash.
Exactly. Very good line.
Great line, Tris. Yeah. He wasn't called that for nothing. I worked with John Conte once. I mean, he didn't do many of them. He kept getting asked when we worked at radio. Of course, he'd been a real pin-up boy, poster boy of the sport, bags of charisma. He kept getting asked, but he didn't really want to do it too much for BBC Radio. But he did one night agree to do it. But, you know, he was another one really who wasn't that cut out for it, because it was quite a dull fight, the first one we did. And it was like, after about six rounds, you know, and he's supposed to be filling the minute in between the rounds, and he goes, well, you know, and he said, well, there's not much to add there, really. He said, I think you said it all. He said, I can't add much to that. And that was his, so I'd have to kind of do an interview to try and keep it going. How did you score the round though, John? Because, you know, they'd have had to score it. It was a little similar to the other rounds and not too much action. You know, so how do you think Sanson might improve here? You know, that kind of thing, just to fill the minute. I mean, another time, I think in between one of the other rounds, he said, I mean, let's just say it, this is really dull, isn't it? That's a way to keep the people listening, isn't it, on the radio?
Well, sadly, you know, that's you've triggered me there, Ian. So sadly, that reminds me of my interview I did with John for Boxing Life Stories, which I thought was actually quite good. The only thing was, I didn't necessarily get his Scouse humour. I thought he was being a bit pan-faced with me and a bit down. And so some of his answers were very abrupt, and I hadn't realised there was humour attached to them. And then after about an hour and 10 minutes, he said something that wasn't very funny. He said, yeah, it's not very funny, that. A bit like this interview, it's not very good, is it? And we've been going about 70 minutes. And I said, well, actually, John, I think it's all right. He's like, do you? I thought, yes, it's fine. But still, I think people did enjoy it. But yeah, I mean, there was a bit of a clash. Plus, I think that happened. It was our first proper sit down. It was right at the start of the pandemic. It was done via...
But he just told it like it was, didn't he? I mean, I wasn't criticising him, really. I mean, why should he be great at doing the BBC radio summarising? He'd never done it before. But he just said what was in his head, so he told it like it was. He wasn't dressing it up, wasn't giving any trimmings to us. So,
yeah, you know, as, there, like, there his it was. Description, like his description of my interview. so, anyway, John, I'll come back to you. In terms of you know, we've touched upon blooper reels and that kind of stuff before. Have you dropped anyone in it and said, oh, have you seen this and not seen anything, or any incidents with co-coms that spring to mind where you've had, you know, I'm trying to think, gremlins in the technology and different things like that?
I'll tell you one thing which does spring to mind since you mentioned that. 2013 was it when Jamie McDonnell fought in Doncaster open air when he was fighting for the world title, promoted by Dennis Hobson, and Dennis had asked me to commentate on it, and he'd brought Jamie Moore along as co-commentator. And in the afternoon, you know, I mean, May in Doncaster in the afternoon, it can be very nice, and he Jamie had put on a lovely pale grey lightweight suit, and I was sort of similarly attired. Anyway, we got there, and the temperature began to drop, and then it dropped a bit more. And a bit more after that. And the pair of us were so cold, you wouldn't believe. It was one, I can't remember ever being very much colder in a commentary place because, you know, I mean, it's a classic thing, isn't it? There's no such thing as cold. It's just inappropriate dress. And my God, were we inappropriately dressed.
That's brilliant. Ian, how about you? Any incidents or fallout or anything like that with CoComs?
Not really, you know. I mean, obviously, you work better with some than others. And one little thing just springs to mind off the top of my head. The co-commentator was sitting next to me. We were in Vegas doing Colin Jones and Milton McCrory, and for some reason that connected probably with television times. It was in like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, local time. Now imagine that in the summer in Las Vegas. It was about 115 degrees. You know, these two guys are trying to fight. So I've bought this great big can or cup of Coca-Cola to try and keep me amused. And I've got a wet towel on my shoulder because the sun's beating down from behind me, trying to do the commentary. And we used to have a producer called Emily McMahon there. So she's at ringside with us, and she reached past the CoCom at the time to point something out to me and knocked the Coca-Cola all over my notes for the fight. They were like, so it just ran. There was nothing on the page left. It all just spread the ink. So I had to just screw it up, throw it on the floor and said, try and remember what their records were, the whole thing, because we do a lot of prep for these fights, believe it or not. You hope you don't have to use it, but, you know, you need it as a reference point at some point. There you are.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll talk about him in more depth down the line here, but you have to mention him a couple of times, and there you're talking about prep. Bob Mee was a staple for Sky for a couple of decades, I think, and he was the guy doing the stats and the notes. And, you know, I've seen many of his notes over the years, and it was intricately detailed and thousands of words and basically full biographies on everyone on the bill, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, what Bob didn't know about boxing wasn't worth knowing. He made us look good week by week, particularly on, you know, obscure undercard fighters, people who were like, you know, coming on at 6:30 p.m., I should say, you know, ahead of a main fight at 11 o'clock. We'd have to be pretty well briefed on all the fighters on the bill. We'd be there for a few days. We maybe got to talk to a few of them and build up our notes. But Bob was deadly accurate and absolutely brilliant. And in a way, he was the unsung star of Sky Sports coverage of boxing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And John, obviously you're still doing it you're still doing the boxing very much. You did Joe Joyce Parker recently, and you're working with the likes of Carl Frampton and David Haye. How do they fit alongside some of the greats that you've worked with?
Oh, they're both nice guys, you know, and they're both prepared to say things, which is the important thing. You have to, as a commentator, as a summariser, once your boxing career has ended, you've got to be prepared to step back and actually say things. And I think both of them are pretty good at that. You know, and Carl particularly has got a lovely sense of humour, mischievous sense of humour, which comes across. And he's sufficiently current now to have actually been in the ring and being in training camp with a lot of the guys that he's talking about. So you get a very real insight from that point of view. David has that kind of a bit of that star quality as well, doesn't he? He had that crossover appeal as a fighter, and he still has it now. He still looks great for a bloke who's what, in his early 40s now. He's still in tremendous shape. And he gives the coverage a bit of the old star quality.
It is an art form, isn't it, as well? And people forget that. You mentioned it, John, earlier on, being there and calling the fights as they go on and trying to give the right kind of insight and use the right words in the right order. So it shouldn't be underestimated, and it does need a lot of hard work to get that right, and not everybody does.
I think the longer you do it, the more you sort of become aware and of what you need to be saying and what you need to be doing to actually bring the best out of the guys alongside you. Just please tell that story once again about when you were commentating with Frank Maloney. I want to hear that one more, just one more time, please.
Well, okay, all right. Yeah, it bears the repetition. I think, and apologies if anybody has heard it before. This is the Riddick Bowe, or one of the Riddick Bowe Galotta fights, the one that ends in the riot. And Lou Duva's working the corner, the veteran old trainer in America. So the riot breaks out, and Duva's gets hit with what looks like one of those big mobile phones from that era, and goes down on the floor. Frank Maloney, I told you we should never work with boxing promoters, is working alongside us. And he suddenly blurts out, "Lou Duva's dead! Lou Duva's dead!" This is live on air. And I had sort of, I'm looking at him in a very alarmed fashion. I guess, don't think he is dead. I think, you know, reports of his death may be exaggerated, I would say, Frank. I said, let's just see how the story develops. He's obviously been hurt there. I said, Lou Duva's dead. He kept showing it. You can hear it in the background on the tape of the fight. But
he was carried out of the arena on a stretcher, though, wasn't he? He wasn't in.
Yeah, I think he was having a heart attack, wasn't he? I think.
Something like that. I mean, Lou lived.
He wasn't dead.
Lou lived to be about 95. You know.
Yeah.
He wasn't a young man when Riddick Bowe was fighting, but yeah, he had a bit of a dodgy turn. Lou was also one of these incredibly competitive and habitually angry men in the corner. If something upset him, he'd be into the ring, going across, wanting to have a fight with the other corner. Despite the fact he's this little white-haired man who looked a little bit like Fred Flintstone, he's about 80 years old, but he'd have a go at the referee, he'd have a go at corner men, he'd have a go at the fighters if he thought his people were being wronged. He was a fiery character. So at that time, you know, people maybe don't know too much about Lou who are listening to that. He was a big character, and Frank Maloney saying he was dead, I think there were a lot of people thinking, oh my God, what's happening here?
Yeah, so going back to Richie Woodall, by the way, John, I'm not sure if you were there. I think you were probably in Vegas with him. I'm not sure if it wasn't the Amir Khan Maidana fight. I think it was an Amir Khan fight in Vegas. And I remember speaking to Richie there. We were at a press conference, pre-fight press conference. And Richie was bright red and he'd been out. And I said, Rich, you caught the sun, mate. And he said, yes, I went out for a run this morning. And I might have even been his first trip to Vegas. And he said, I thought I'd just run down the end of the strip and to the Stratosphere, that, you know, the big tall building down the end. And I think obviously in Vegas, everything looks a lot closer than it actually is, isn't it? And I don't think he planned when he set off in the morning, think he was probably going to do half an hour's run, that he was actually doing an 8 mile round trip. And he came back absolutely like a tomato and say, I couldn't believe how far it was. It just kept going and going and going.
Well, there's a story to be done. We ought to do one of these about Las Vegas at some point, because there's been so many great stories about that. But it's that clear desert air, isn't it? The fact that the hotels are so vast and the clear desert air. You think that it's only a short walk down to go, for argument's sake, from the MGM down to Caesar's Palace. But it's actually a good, you know, it's a good half hour walk, that, and just the idea of running down to the Stratosphere, my God.
Yeah, and then there was one, I've asked you to dish the dirt on these big nights out with Glenn and the rest guys, but there must have been obviously times where you've dined out, and John, people love that story of you and the odd looking soup or the creation that you were having in Paris in Las Vegas. People have been enjoying that. I'm guessing you guys have had, you know, with your co-coms, you've been into some weird and wonderful places, whether it's in the ghettos in America or fine dining in New York or whatever, Ian.
Yeah, well, I remember going, we went to this Italian restaurant one night in Las Vegas, and it became pretty apparent to us quite quickly that it was kind of like a mafia-run place. We felt a bit edgy in there. And so, you know, they caught our British accents, and the guy, one of the guys came over to us and started sort of talking in a sort of, I don't know, there was something, you know, it's a bit like out of The Sopranos to us. He's going, you guys don't like American fighters. What's the matter with you? You don't like American fighters. I've heard that. You know, I said, no. I said, we're fine with American fighters. We cover them all the time. That's not what I heard. I heard you didn't like them because you come from another part of the world, right? And I'm going, no, it's fine. I'm thinking, I'm looking at Glenn and Bob Mead. I'm thinking, we need to move out of here. This is a bit threatening. This guy, I don't know why he'd even kind of come over, but you know, he was one of the waiters or one of the co-owners. And yeah, the whole feel of the night was a bit on the edgy side. So that was just one night in Vegas, of which there were many, of course.
I've got to tell, since we're on the Richie Woodall subject, and Richie would undoubtedly tell this about me if he were on here rather than me talking about him. It was his 40th birthday. We were over in Las Vegas and we decide we're going to go for a good night out. So we go and see some live music in one of the bars. I think we're in that Irish bar down there in New York, New York. And we wind up having a few drinks, et cetera, et cetera. And one thing leads to another. And before you know where you are, a few drinks becomes quite a lot of drinks. And by the end of the evening, I think Richie had assumed that he would be the one being helped back to his bed. In fact, come the end of the evening, Richie, who's celebrating his 40th birthday, was the one helping me back to my bed. It was an interesting night out. And that night, I will hold my hands up and say, yep, I had the hangover the next day, big time.
The next day wasn't the fight, though, of course, John.
No.
This was four nights before, isn't it? Of course.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't do that the night before a big commentary, can you? It always got to be scrupulously professional in that respect.
Yeah,
Ian, who's your favourite double act, Ian? When you look at classic double acts over the years, I mean, obviously there was Lampley and Foreman, and you know that very strong HBO team back in the day. That was
I never heard any of that. Though I was commentating alongside them along the row. I didn't hear Jim Lampley very much at all. We used to go to the production meeting with HBO and meet them. But I always had the feeling, really, that we were slightly an afterthought. We just listened in on their production meeting. So I didn't hear them as commentators. Favourites? I just have that big respect for Harry doing it on his own all those years. If you wanted me to pick somebody out, Harry Carpenter, on his own all those years before Double Axe became... the thing.
Oh my God, he's won it back at 32.
Yeah, that's it. The Rumble in the Jungle. What a great line. I mean, the great lines live on forever, don't they? And you just picked one there, John. Yeah. Oh my God, he's won the world title back at 32, ... and he's doing his shuffle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not aged as well now that 32 is no age for a world champion, is it? But yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it was a huge thing at the time. John, how about you? Favourite double act?
It was the incredulity in Harry's voice as well. You know, he got it. It was bang on the money.
I was a fan of Ian and Glenn, without sort of blowing too much smoke in the direction of Ian's backside. I thought together on air they were terrific. They, you know, talk about chemistry, and they certainly had it. Glenn and Ian were very, very good indeed. And somebody on the other side of the pond who kind of deserves a mention, I think, who's got his autobiography coming out not too long. I think it's due out in March. Colonel Bob Sheridan, one of the great characters of American broadcasting. And he goes right the way back to the days of Muhammad Ali. He's now 79 years old, doesn't do it anymore, but to say he was a party animal is one of the great understatements of all time. But he knew boxing inside out. I think he's completing this book at the moment, and he's had, I think through his life, he's had 9 heart attacks or something, and he's still going strong. And if you listen to his commentary of Ali Foreman, that is just a brilliant piece of work, because he picks up very, very early on when a lot of people who were there at the time were thinking, what's Ali doing? He's lying back on the ropes and this is suicide. He's getting clubbed by Foreman. Foreman's, and he picked it up very, very early in the fight that Foreman was in fact beginning to punch his way out, and he was starting to gas. He wasn't going to stay the full distance of the fight. And he picked up very early on that this was cute tactics from Muhammad Ali. And he got it absolutely right. And it was one of the great pieces of commentary, I think.
He's a great American boxing voice, the Colonel, Bob Sheridan, a much loved character. And talking of other guys on the other side of the Atlantic, and you mentioned Jim Lampley there, one of the HBO team who I used to really like was Larry Merchant. Not, wasn't everybody's cup of tea, those slow motion interviews that he used to do, but he had a journalistic mind as well. He never got on with Roy Jones Jr. And I remember Roy Jones Jr. had a way of talking about himself in the third person. So he's doing this interview with Larry Merchant, and Roy Jones Jr. is saying, everybody knows that when Roy Jones Jr. gets in the ring, there's nothing like him. He's the fastest man on the planet. Roy Jones Jr., ain't anybody going to be able to touch Roy Jones Jr.? And there's a big gap, and Larry Merchant comes in and goes, when you talk about Roy Jones Jr., you mean you, don't you? It's absolutely put him away. and then Jones goes off into this big, you've never given me a fair shake. You've never given me a fair shake. And of course, you know, Larry had that big thing with, didn't he, in the ring with Floyd Mayweather. Yeah. You know, when Mayweather puts on him and says the same thing about how Merchant had never given him a fair shake and how HBO should fire him. I mean, it was an astonishing attack in response to a fairly innocent question, as I recall it, or a valid question. And Larry Merchant comes back at him and says, if I was 20 years younger, I'd whip your ass.
It might have been 50 years, I think, Ian. I think it might have been 50
years. Was it 50? Yeah, 50.
Must have been some fighter when he was younger.
I'm going to say, that would have been a hell of a match. They'd have sold tickets for that.
I was going to say that would be on pay-per-view today. And then obviously I just wanted to touch upon the Showtime guys, because I'm not dismissing them, but Al Bernstein, Steve Farhood, Jim Gray, they've all made huge contributions over the years. John, have you had anything to do with Al and the rest?
Only to pick his brain and talk to him about fights, and likewise the other guys. But I think Al Bernstein particularly, you know, he goes back a long, long way, doesn't he? And he's been broadcasting on big fights forever. And you respect people with that sort of knowledge. And when people really know the game like he does, he doesn't thrust it down your throat. He won't be going and giving it the big I am and saying, I think this, I think that, unless you go and ask him. And Al's very much like that. And I always found him very generous with his knowledge if you chose to speak to him.
Yeah, great. I think all those three you mentioned, absolutely brilliant. Couldn't fault them. Love listening to all of them.
Well, and the Jim Gray thing that he was most known for was when he confronted a very angry and snarling Mike Tyson after the bite fight, wasn't it? And that really solidified his reputation, I think, because I think that was award-winning journalism at the time, when Jim Gray really, you know, Tyson wasn't speaking to anyone and Jim Gray didn't let him out of have an easy way out of the interview at all, which was terrific TV. And I think you can go back and watch it on YouTube. But gents, this was a lot of fun. Is there anything that you'd like to add about any of your co-coms to stitch them up before we conclude?
Well, I think most of the ones I've worked with, it's been an absolute pleasure, you know, and I hope that it goes on for a fair few years to come. I think most of them have been great fun to be alongside, and you know, help me understand more about boxing than I otherwise would, which is kind of what it's all about.
Yeah. I mean, I'd just like to thank them all, really, for enhancing the commentary and adding their insights. And I'd like to thank them as well for putting up with me all those years.
And we'd like to thank everyone for listening and for tuning in. If you are enjoying Ringside Rewind, please like and share on social media, copy the link and share it far and wide as we try to grow the podcast. Gents, Ian and John, thank you so much for joining me this week, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.